Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Dow, the Fed, and inflation today. What's that? You say you need more? All right, how about helium, cable television, and Wall Street stand-up comedy? Yes, we do cover it all from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, everybody, the 22nd of November. Great to have you here for the podcast. And we will start today with the week that was. 5 days, 4 minutes, maybe four and a half, I don't know, to wrap up the week on Wall Street and beyond. For that, we've got Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. She is in New York City. Sudeep Reddy from the Wall Street Journal is down in Washington, D.C. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
Do not feel obliged to answer this question, but I just want to lay it out there for either one of you. Any comments on the Dow at 16,000, or should we just move right on?
Look, just in time for the holidays. You know, this all feels sort of like the Truman Show, orchestrated by a higher order.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's true. It's good. The punch bowl's still there.
Punch bowl is still there. Well, which are you checking my notes? Because that's my segue here. The Fed minutes from their most recent meeting came out this week. Sudeep, there is, increased speculation, I guess one could say, that the punch bowl will be taken away. The taper will be upon us. First of all, how likely do you think that is and when?
It is definitely going to happen.
It's a certainty that it's going to happen. That's right.
Yeah. It may not happen in the next month, but it is going to happen. And that's one reason why you have to look at Dow 16,000 and wonder whether it's something that's gotten way ahead of itself. The Fed realizes that the stock market has gone up and up. Investors are pursuing more and more risk without really worrying about the consequences. They see that, but they don't want to pull the rug out from under the economy. And they are very cautious and a little bit worried about the endless bond buying. So they're looking for an opportunity to pull back. They would love that to be a stronger economy. It's just not clear we're going to get one in the coming months at the level they want before they can pull back.
Lee, that's a scary concept that investors are taking on more risk. We don't need to hear that, do we?
No, we don't. But I mean, it's with every passing month, it seems to be, and as the Dow gets loftier and loftier, that's exactly what's happening. And that's the point. I mean, that's the point of accommodative Fed policy.
Right.
But you know, it just begs the question, how does this end and when does it end? And, you know, there was an obvious reason why it didn't end in October, because there were concerns that the government shutdown had slowed things down more so than they actually did. But, you know, the end is coming soon. That said, you know, the Fed is still very concerned about unemployment. And as long as that is still where it is, that will also have an impact.
One thing the Fed apparently is not concerned about at all, Sudeep, and with reason, is inflation. Consumer Price Index was out this week. The wholesale price, the producer price index, wholesale inflation was out this week. They were both down over a month ago. I mean, why? How can it be that the prices are still stuck?
That's one of the one big conundrum for the economy right now. Inflation, at least a little more inflation, would be a high class problem for us to have with our economy the way it is. Any talk of weak inflation and even deflation is usually just reflective of a lethargic economy. And having an overheating economy would seem like a gift from above. We're just not getting there. And it's not just us. It's developed economies around the world are not getting there, and they're not getting there fast enough. And it makes you wonder what will actually pull us out of this, because trillions and trillions of dollars of money printing hasn't exactly done it. But something is going to click at some point. The question is when.
Yeah, of course. Lee, a couple of reminders of the financial crisis this week. General Motors, the Treasury Department said it's going to unload the last of its stock at some point in the not too distant future, maybe lose a couple of billion, make a couple of billion. J.P. Morgan with that $13 billion settlement in the past week or so. Are you not still amazed that we're still dealing with this 5 years later, 6 years later?
I'm not. I mean, it was a pretty earth-shattering event. And I think GM is actually a reminder of just how close and how much worse things would have been had we not bailed out the auto companies. Just imagine how many jobs would have been lost and how much worse that recession would have been if, in fact, anything truly terrible had happened to GM. As bad as things were, that was one bright spot.
Sudeep, is it now behind us, do you think? I mean, I can't imagine a bigger settlement than $13 billion from J.P. Morgan, and I can't imagine a bigger deal than us taking over a car company and getting rid of it.
Getting past both of those is really huge for our economy and for our national psyche. If you look at GM in particular, that was a symbol of an activist federal government stepping in. It was, if you like that thing, it was the government at its best stepping in to save the economy from a market failure. If you don't like that thing, then it was what precipitated the rise of the Tea Party and all the fights about the debt ceiling and the shutdown and the sequester and whether the government has gone too far. But getting past that allows us to move on and hopefully move on to a different, more calmer era for the economy and for the government.
Interesting point about the national psyche on a day like today. Sudeep Reddy from the Wall Street Journal down in Washington. Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine in New York City. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, have a nice weekend. 50 years ago today, speaking of the national psyche, the Dow off 21 points, 2.9% back then on the Dow. Today, yet another record high above 16,000. We will have the details when we do the numbers. It's going to be a whole new world when the Senate gets back from its Thanksgiving recess in a couple of weeks. The filibuster rules change from yesterday is what I'm talking about. A simple majority, just 51 votes, will now suffice to get a presidential nominee to the floor for a vote by the full Senate. And there are plenty of vacancies to be filled, 90 judiciary jobs, among many others in the executive branch. Marketplace's David Gura reports the change is something like the end of a government hiring freeze.
We're talking about the kind of job Mike Posner used to have. He was Assistant Secretary of State for the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor. It took him 5 months to get confirmed, and he says he wasn't an outlier.
Bureau's senior positions in the State Department not filled for months and months at a time, and it really makes doing work a lot more difficult.
Ken Salazar was President Obama's first Secretary of the Interior. And he says the worst thing about this de facto hiring freeze is
you're not able to bring the effective leadership to manage the government of the United States.
Jobs requiring Senate confirmation became less and less attractive. Nominees have had to wait in what Salazar calls a very strange limbo.
And I've seen both Democrats and Republicans who've just gotten tired of the wait and who have withdrawn their names.
So what happens now that the logjam is broken? Austin Goolsbee was the chair of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors, and he says the queue is full of mid-level appointees.
Deputy secretaries, undersecretaries, assistant secretaries, who are the people that kind of have to make the trains run on time.
Goolsbee says he expects things will move a lot less glacially now.
I would presume they're going to get all of those people through pretty quick.
But the bottom line here is not that these nominees are going to get jobs. It's what they're going to do once they have them. They'll make rules and regulations that will affect business and the whole economy. Next year, for example, the Fed has 3 vacancies. And at least one analyst is predicting that this rule change will make it much easier for the president to get his picks confirmed. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
As the White House grinds away at a fix for healthcare.gov, the nuts and bolts of how to let people keep their coverage is being worked out by insurance companies and by state healthcare exchanges. The state of California, where Covered California, the exchange out here, is signing up 10,000 new people a day, says it's not going to let people keep their canceled policies for another year. From the health desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has that story.
6,900. That's how many 18 to 34-year-olds signed up for insurance on California's exchange in October alone, nearly a quarter of all customers. But those young invincibles might stay away if they could renew the cheap, bare-bones policies that were canceled under the ACA. And USC professor Neeraj Sood says that would threaten California's success.
Now, premiums for this plan go up because premiums have to cover the cost of providing health care for this now more sicker population.
States are deciding whether to let insurers renew plans that don't meet certain ACA standards, like covering pre-existing conditions and out-of-pocket spending caps. And insurers are deciding whether they want to reissue those. Professor Sood isn't sure there's much incentive for the companies to sell bargain basement coverage anymore.
I think with the new rules, you can sell a Toyota Corolla at full price to the consumers, or you can sell a BMW where the government gives you a 50% discount.
Not all insurers sell plans on the exchanges, so those firms could make money if they peel consumers away. But Drexel University public health professor Robert Field says he thinks most of the companies are playing the long game.
When you cut through all of the politics, they are getting tens of millions of potential new customers, and the government is requiring many of those people to buy their products.
Field says if insurers can extend these policies only another 12 months, there's not too much to be gained. The real action is on the exchanges. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
The internet, as it has done for so many other industries, has opened up the art world to everyone. It's a multi-billion dollar business that's being filtered out through hundreds of new websites. And at the same time, artists keep on creating new ways to sell their work online. Ike Skrískandaraja reports now from Oakland, California.
Victor Vazquez is lying on his bed, drawing symbols on a blank sheet of paper.
Probably a yin-yang, maybe a decapitated dog head. Maybe a peace sign, a weed leaf, money sign.
Vazquez started cultivating his artistic style during his last gig, fronting the rap group Das Racist.
You want to put it in marketplace terms. You know, I already developed a brand that people, you know, have come to love and trust.
Quick draw, McGraw. I went to art school with the art fools, with the smart fools, with the sophomores, with the freshmen. I went to art college. I got the art knowledge.
But since Das Racist broke up last year, the rap money dried up, so Vazquez tried cashing in on his other talent.
I just kind of doodled on a piece of wood at my friend's house and put it on the internet for $100, and someone bought it, so I kept doing that.
Vazquez posts his art for sale on Twitter and Instagram, where it's mostly bought by fans of his music. This year, he says he sold nearly $5,000 worth of art.
Here, let me add one more little zigzag on it.
In about half an hour, he's filled the page with wavy lines around icons from the Coexist bumper sticker and corporate America.
That's probably good.
When it's ready for sale, he uploads the picture to Instagram.
$100.
Tags it, prices it, tweets the link, and then he sits back and waits for a buyer.
I think people tend to like the simple $100 thing, you know, but who knows what people like, man.
Fans seem to like Vazquez's simple style and pricing. Patrons also like buying more polished works online. In recent years, 300 businesses have been established to help connect art with art buyers, ranging from the craft-oriented Etsy to eBay to dedicated online galleries like the San Francisco-based U Gallery. Director and co-founder, Alex Farkas.
We like to help people who don't have galleries around them or patrons, so that's one fantastic thing about the internet.
Works on UGallery sell on average for $700, but you can get a painting for as little as $100.
For a long time, the art world was a pretty narrow space. You had to be involved with the gallery scene, know where to go, know the questions to ask, and now there's such a wealth of information available to people, both to learn about art if you're a first-timer, and then even to start buying art.
The white wall galleries of the traditional art market have fallen, or at least lowered to let in more first-time buyers, like most of Victor Vazquez's patrons.
Oh, yeah, new scene, yeah. So I just got, hold on, someone named Jenkins Joe on Instagram left a comment on your photo, let me buy this.
And with a swap of some PayPal information, the trade is made. It may not be a Sotheby's auction, but Jenkins Joe got an original piece of art, and Victor Vazquez made $100 with Sharpie and social media. In Oakland, I'm Ike Skrískandaraja for Marketplace.
Ike's story was produced for us by Turnstile News. That's a project of Youth Radio. Coming up,
I plan to come out swinging and leave it all on the stage. So hopefully I'll close this transaction.
Wall Street bankers turned stand-up comedians. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials up 54 points today, a third of 1%, 16,064 the number. The NASDAQ nudged up 22 points, about a half percent, 39.91. The S&P 500 lifted 8 points, a half percent, closed at 1804. For the week, the Dow up 6 tenths of 1%. The S&P 500 gained 4 tenths. The NASDAQ chalked up a 1 tenth of 1% gain. Healthcare got a shot in the arm today as several drug companies won approval from regulators here and in Europe. Biogen IDEC hopped up 13% today. Gilead Sciences rose 3 6/10%. Ariad Pharmaceuticals soared 35% today. Software maker Splunk Incorporated jumped 22% on better-than-expected quarterly results. Hardware moved the other way. Intel chipped off 5% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.74%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. The National Association of Realtors releases its pending home sales index for October. The Capitol Christmas tree is scheduled to arrive in Washington, D.C. It departed Washington State at the beginning of the month and is traveling with 5,000 handmade ornaments. And 14 years ago, Alien Gonzalez was rescued off the coast of Florida. He'd been with a group attempting to journey from Cuba to the U.S. He was 5. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We had Brian Roberts, the CEO of Comcast, on the program yesterday. We were talking about, among other things, consolidation in the cable business. And wouldn't you know, Comcast is back in the news today for that very reason. CNBC reports the company is thinking about making an offer for Time Warner Cable. Charter Communications is apparently also in that mix. And while they're just browsing for now, Marketplace's Sabri Benishor explains the cable industry is under pressure to change.
I had to walk about 5 feet to see the pressure on the cable industry. That pressure is called Meg.
Hi, my name is Meg Kramer.
She's 25, producer for the Marketplace Tech Report.
Do you have cable?
Like TV?
Uh-huh.
No.
Do you know anybody that has cable?
No. My parents have cable.
People, especially those under 30, aren't wedded to cable. They have smartphones and tablets and...
the internet.
Cable's not going to go out of business tomorrow, but the industry is under significant pressure.
Porter Bibb is with MediaTek Capital.
Consolidation has become a way of surviving in cable.
Cable operators need to consolidate to get bigger, so they have more negotiating power over channels and networks that have been demanding more and more of cable company profits. Those content producers have been more demanding because they have other ways of getting to audiences. But incidentally, that's also why a merger might not trigger antitrust laws. Bob Land directs the American Antitrust Institute.
The antitrust laws prevent a lessening of competition in any relevant market. The problem here is, what markets are we talking about?
Cable competes with all the stuff that producer Meg watches, not just other cable companies. Boston University economist Lawrence Kotlikoff says consolidation might fly legally, but it won't be a good deal for consumers.
You get this monopolistic behavior where they charge much higher prices and give you lousy customer service.
What? Lousy customer service from a cable company? That's crazy. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishor for Marketplace.
Our every now and then contributor Justin Rowlett from the BBC has been working on a series about new ways to look at the global economy. He calls it elementary business, as in the chemical elements. That is, today from the top right corner of the periodic table, helium. Justin, good to have you back. How you been?
I'm very well indeed.
Helium. It's the stuff that makes your voice sound different, right?
It makes your voice sound funny if you inhale it. I have to say, it is a little bit dangerous to inhale it. If you inhale too much, you can suffocate yourself. Well, it's an inert gas, so it won't poison you. But what it will do is displace oxygen. And obviously, that's quite important. But it is a fascinating substance. Here's an element that we are slowly but inexorably losing. Because helium is so light
that it escapes from the Earth's atmosphere. And yet at the same time, it's very, very important.
Well, if it's so important and rare and vital, as you say, why are we putting it in kids' party balloons?
Well, to be honest, that is what a lot of chemists are asking. They're saying here in helium, we've got this kind of unique and really important element, and we are just wasting it literally for fun. One of the amazing qualities of helium is that as a liquid, it is the coldest substance on Earth. And because it's so cold, it has functions for things like superconducting elements. So every MRI scanner has helium at the heart of it. Wow. They can't operate without this incredibly cold material.
Now, we have here something called the U.S. Helium Strategic Reserve, right?
You do still have it, although, there was a fear that the helium reserve might be closed down, that we might suddenly have a helium cliff. There might not be helium available for people who wanted to make things like MRI scanners. And such was the fear from the helium industry that one of the very few bills passed by the US Congress during that recent US government shutdown was a bill to ensure that the helium reserve kept open.
Is it a thing that you mine? Do you go prospecting for it? How do you get it?
Helium occurs alongside natural gas. And historically, down in Texas, you've had natural gas reserves which had quite a high proportion of helium. I'm talking 1-3%. That's considered quite a high proportion. Huh. Originally, it just used to be pumped off into the atmosphere. And then people thought, hold on, this gas is actually quite useful. Let's collect it.
When you go out on the open market, is it getting cheaper or more expensive? What's going on?
Well, here is the thing. It is rising in price. And interesting, I mean, a lot of chemists would say it's much cheaper than it should be. Huh. Because as I said at the beginning, this is a finite reserve of this stuff and it is very useful. But it prices have been rising and people are anxious they'll go on rising. And they're worried that'll have consequences in terms of how much it will cost to make things like MRI scanners. Mm-hmm. And therefore, how much it will cost for us all to be treated for kind of medical conditions like cancer. So there's a big concern around helium at the moment.
Justin Rowlett at the BBC. Justin, we'll talk soon.
We certainly will. Thank you, Kai.
Humor can help ease the pain or, honestly, the boredom of financial news. So we have comedians on from time to time to get their take on the world of business. Those who work on Wall Street have their own brand of comedy to help get them through the day. And those two worlds collided the other night in a New York comedy club at a contest for amateur comics who work in finance. Marketplace's Mark Garrison was there.
It's a cold night, but Gotham Comedy Club is seating pretty close to a full house. Finance folks will be on a stage where legends got started, and big stars still drop in to try out new material with an intimate crowd.
Jerry Seinfeld, Sherry Shepherd, Ed Helms from The Hangover.
That's Andy Engel, the club's director of new talent, the polite term for amateur.
People on Wall Street are gambling huge amounts of money, and that takes a lot of balls. So I think the confidence is something that you could definitely transfer over from Wall Street to doing stand-up.
Tonight's a bringer show. That means the Wall Street comics have to bring a gang of paying customers to get stage time. Hard-drinking finance types are a profitable crowd.
I plan to come out swinging and leave it all on the stage. So hopefully I'll close this transaction.
Down in the green room, MetLife financial advisor Ken Gross is prepping an act that deals with how the old days are gone.
I've been in the financial industry now for more years than I wish to admit, and things have really, really changed.
Do you know now our budget for entertaining a client is $25? That's one lap dance. What do I do after that?
No surprises here. Plenty of material we can't play on the radio mocked Wall Street's hunger for money, drugs, and sex. But a couple performers gripped the mic to go after Wall Street's critics.
You know, I don't understand it. People always say things like, you know, people in finance make a lot of money. Well, I got news for you, Gotham. Yeah. We do.
That's financial advisor Greg Cantone launching what comics call a room divider, a provocative bit that got big laughs and groans as he went on to say nurses and teachers are overpaid. Besides the suits, you could pick out the finance pros by who laughed. Like the contestants, most were white and male, but not all.
So you may not be able to know it by looking at me, but I work on Wall Street. Mm-hmm, give it up. I know y'all think that black people don't walk on Wall Street. Kiss my ass. I don't get coffee.
Sheila Smiley, who works on a mostly white trading floor, held the mic close and leaned in to offer a stock tip.
Don't trust white people with your money.
The other black contestant, Khalif Scott, works for a market data company.
Your white friends always want you to interpret. They're like, Khalif, what did he say? I do not know.
He stayed away from financial jokes, but it didn't count against him.
All right, and our first prize winner. Who's going to win? Yes. It's Khalif, everybody!
After the show, I caught up with one of the judges, working comic Robin Montague. She liked the finance comics, but said Wall Street material isn't enough.
They're going to have to think of other things. You know, it's money. If you have it, you don't want to talk about it. And if you don't, we want to beat them up.
She was kind of in a hurry to leave.
These financial guys have invited me down to the bar on the corner, and they're going to all buy me drinks. They've got it like that, and I'm going.
Bankers may not be comedy gold, but they can always provide liquidity. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, today in which the Affordable Care Act, yes, takes it on the chin. Again, the Obama administration announced this afternoon it's going to delay the deadline for people to sign up for insurance coverage that would start on New Year's Day. It's not a big slip. 8 days, December the 15th to the 23rd would be the new deadline to allow for problems with the website. As with all things ACA related, though, you'd have to stay tuned. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace on a Friday. Today, the Dow up 54 points, about a third of 1%. The NASDAQ nudged up 22 points, about a half percent. The S&P 500 gained 8 points, about a quarter percent. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yore. The program is produced by Star Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer around here. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Have a good weekend. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.